Good evening, folks, and welcome back on this Saturday, the 3rd day of November, 2018. I'm your host, Mark Call. And what a week it's been! There's an election scheduled for next week, so we all already knew that the false flags, fake news, and smokescreens would be fast and furious, almost like the point is to keep anything really important off the front pages, at least until it's too late. Over the weekend, for example, there was a mass murder in Pittsburgh at the Tree of Life Synagogue, and the media was so hot to blame Trump, they almost forgot about the fact that there really was a nutcase who actually pulled the trigger. That story, at least, was sufficient for a while to take the focus off of the last nutcase, the bogus bomber allegedly in Florida, before too many of the embarrassing contradictions there, like his Trump-mobile, literally covered with suspiciously new-looking bumper stickers, could actually get any press coverage. But by then, the story had already served its intended purpose anyway. Meanwhile, the mercenary migrant invasion caravan from the south and the stories that should have been surrounding it continue to pick up steam. We're up to at least four or so by this point. And for a lot of reasons that we'll come back to, it seems like the threat level is increasing, along with the media attempts to downplay and ignore it, until they decide the time is ripe. So with all that on the table, let's start with a couple of completely different stories that your host thinks are interesting, if for no other reason than what I'm going to call the duh effect. Like this one. A breathless headline from the Daily Mail says, "Who could have thought it? Cell phones are linked to cancer, says a new landmark study from NIH. Not invented here. Results show clear evidence of tumor growth after repeated exposure to radiation. Who could have thought it?" And now it says, "Final results show clear evidence of a link between heart, brain, and adrenal gland cancers in male rats." And gee, folks, it's not like we haven't seen increased tumors on the correct side of the brain, whichever side of the brain people hold their cell phones on, for years now. But as your host has been saying for a while, if you thought 2G, 3G, and 4G cell phones were bad, or especially, I guess, if you didn't, just wait till you see the effects of the new immersion technologies that people are going to be exposed to when 5G comes to your block, whether you like it or not. Because in this case, there really are health studies. Even if you're not going to be told about them, for several trillion easy reasons, why do you think militaries worldwide are adopting millimeter wave technology for weapons systems? Here's another similar quick story from the Public Intelligence blog and Rebecca Campbell. It should be one of those duh stories, except for a reason that I think you'll find obvious. The U.S. government has lost a vaccine lawsuit, basically demonstrating, as Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has been trying to point out, that they've lied to the public for decades about autism and vaccines. RFK Jr., Dell Big Tree, producer of the suppressed documentary entitled Vaxxed, and the Informed Consent Action Network, or ICANN, are credited with the victory, which demanded that the federal government release documents proving that all federally approved vaccines had been tested for quality over the past 32 years. And it turned out there weren't any. The story says people need to understand some of the implications of this lawsuit loss, like the fact that the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, SIC, and all the vaccine manufacturers have been lying to the American people for over 30 years about their safety and effectiveness, which also means vaccine makers have been fraudulently exempted from what all other pharmaceutical drug makers have been forced to do concerning recertification for quality and effectiveness. And that means that their vaccines have never really been tested for quality and have had no proven safety or effectiveness for, again, about 3 decades. They even suggest that this case could now be legally cited by parents who've been mandated, whether they like it or not, in other words, to subject their children to something that might very well kill them or cause permanent health issues. Likewise, for employer mandates, especially for those in the healthcare profession who should know better. The true duh story of the week, though, also demonstrates hypocrisy on a scale almost never before seen in America, but we're getting increasingly used to this kind of thing anyway. And it's so over the top that if it wasn't quite so disgusting, it would almost be funny. As Zero Hedge puts it, the paragon of political correctness and the queen of virtue signaling, Hitlery herself, sat down with Recode's Kara Swisher over the weekend to answer questions about just how evil and awful anyone who doesn't agree with them, i.e., anybody she refers to as deplorables, must be. And since this really is so ugly, quotes won't get it, folks. We need to go right to the recording.
What's often called political correctness is politeness.
Right.
It's not being rude and insulting to people.
What, you mean like calling them deplorables and wanting to take away their constitutionally protected rights? Or just treating them like idiots? And yeah, folks, I'm going to skip over all the insulting, in-your-face whoppers about how the Democrat Party is so much more inclusive than those evil Republicans, in spite of the hypocrisy and even a bit of primary election rigging, which probably didn't make Barry's socialists feel all that included.
And I don't want to go around insulting people. I don't want to paint with a broad brush. Every immigrant is this. Every African-American is that. Every, you know...
Secret Service agent is a pig. Oh, and forget the ones that she called the N-word. The media certainly has.
You know, that's childish.
What do you think of Cory Booker's, and you didn't comment on him, and you feel free
to... Oh, I adore him.
What do you think about him saying, kick them in the shins, essentially, start to get to that kind of political...
Well, that was Eric Holder.
Yeah, Eric Holder,
yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I know they all look alike.
No, they don't. Oh, well done.
Oh, well done, she says. Megyn Kelly just lost her job, but she did get the $69 million payout for one hell of a lot less insulting comment than that. But wait a minute, it was just a joke. It's all in good fun. Maybe not as funny as blackface, though, right, Hitlery? As Zero Hedge points out, and everybody who's listened to this comment is probably thinking, can you imagine if Donald Trump had tried to say something like that? It would be the front page news in every paper across these United States. And CNN and the other fake news networks would literally have it on endless loop replay. It's all in good fun. That is, if you're Hitlery and can get away with things that almost none of the now-fired sports commentators, pundits, columnists, and high-profile, not-so-far-above-the-law politicians have been able to get away with. But I guess if you're Hitlery and can run for president after having committed treason and have managed to get away with saying the N-word all kinds of times and nobody dares to interview her victims, much less air any of the recordings that are probably out there somewhere but won't ever make it to Facebook, Twitter, or YouTube, this is nothing new. The American Mirror's Kyle Olson summarized it this way: Hitlery Clinton appears to benefit from her progressive privilege. There's a great term. It's the only thing that protects her from getting the Roseanne treatment. Remember Roseanne? She's even pretty far left, and that one was obviously a joke. And not being dismissed in disgrace. And did you notice how fast Kara Swisher contradicted her bad joke and said, no, they don't? Obviously, she knows her job would have been at risk if she'd laughed and not stepped in to cover for that racist slip. So, one more time, let's hear the kind of in-your-face racism that's funny, if you're politically correct enough.
Yeah, I know they all look alike.
No, they don't.
I guess, folks, if Hitlery can't ever be president, at least she'll be well qualified for a job with the New York Times editorial board. There are, however, another series of stories still unfolding this week that may even top that one for in-your-face media hypocrisy. I'm talking about a story that, as I do this recording, is still unfolding and is admittedly very speculative and, of course, highly subject to change or to being torpedoed outright by the waste stream and covered up like so many other major rapes by leftists that we've seen in the past. Right, Bill? But in this case, the meta story really is the story. The way the fake news is handling this, as opposed to, say, other high-profile stories of late. So I'll do some disclaimers this time up front, like I did midweek when this thing first came up, when I admitted the most interesting thing about this story is the incredible in-your-face level of hypocrisy that it reveals, whether it's true or not. Think back to Kavanaugh, of course. And remember how little, well, how like zero when it came to actual evidence. All right, even charitably, very little evidence was needed for those accusations to become headline news and beyond for day after day after day. So watch the unbelievable contrast as this one either unfolds or is completely covered up. So as I indicated yesterday when I first mentioned this story, that is the thing I find most interesting. It's the preemptive attack even before the accusers were allowed to come forward, including evidently a preemptive investigation, there's that word again, from the feral bunglers thereof. Evidently they move quickly to protect their own. Compare and contrast that with the Kavanaugh bimbo eruption. And here's the editor's note from the Gateway Pundit's piece. Jim Hoff, they say, is not responsible for the posting of the original story, reporting the accusations against Mueller. That was authored by Jacob Wohl himself. And under most circumstances, he writes, they would allow their writers, based all over the world, to post stories directly to the website. But after Mr. Hoff was notified regarding some of the bases of the claims, he edited and then removed the original articles pending an investigation. And as part of that, Mr. Hoff requested one of the TGP DC reporters to interview Jacob Wohl directly, which was done after Wohl landed in DC, and that is what constitutes the rest of this report by Alicia Powell. Meanwhile, our investigation is ongoing, and we'd appreciate your patience, they say. Until then. So begins this piece, and contrary to claims you may have heard elsewhere in the waste stream, the woman accusing Robert Mueller of rape has nothing to gain financially from coming forward with her allegations against the special counsel, and, imagine this, folks, her testimony can be corroborated. Wow, that sets it apart from, let's just say, a lot of other stuff we've heard of late, said the attorney representing the accuser and the journalist who discovered her. So in the exclusive interview with the Gateway Pundit, journalist and founder of Surefire Intelligence, Jacob Wohl, and Washington, D.C.-based attorney Jack Berkman debunked media reports claiming they paid women to accuse Mueller of sexual assault. And you know who he is. Chief witch hunter in the Russia, 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 much ado about, as it turns out, nothing unless it was something he done to begin with. Wohl admits up front that he's politically incorrect. Quote, I'm the biggest skeptic in the world of the Me Too movement. My default position is not to believe the women. You've seen that over and over again as one story after another's come out, and indeed that was my default position, he said, in this case. I don't care who's getting accused or who's doing the accusing. My default position is I don't believe it until it's proven, until it's corroborated, he told the Gateway Pundit. I went through the story with the accuser, the gal who'd hired our firm, and I asked her many, many questions. Where did it happen? When did it happen? Do you have any corroborating witnesses? And over again, I determined her credibility to be very high, very high. He tells the whole story in some detail. If it turns out to be true, folks, there's time for that later, so I won't spend the time going through it here now, but emphasizes the fact that there was, quote, no quid pro quo here. She was not offered any money. There was no exchange of any kind that happened between myself, that happened between Mr. Berkman here, and this accuser. Which brings us to where the plot thickens, because the waste stream claims otherwise. And your host notes, they did so preemptively, almost like they learned how to handle bimbo eruptions years ago when they're being used against the leftist good guys, oftentimes even before the real accuser is identified or lives to tell her tale, which might end up being the most important part and the real difference in all of these stories. Several major news outlets, notably left-leaning in particular, including Politico and the Daily Beast, have reported that a woman named Lorraine Parsons of Fort Myers, Florida, emailed various reporters, guess where they lean, claiming she was offered money to falsely accuse Mueller of sexual misconduct. Whoa, time out. Imagine that, folks. A woman making a false allegation in exchange for a whole lot of money and a bunch of notoriety besides. Have we ever, ever heard anything like that? Recently, let me just interject a quick headline from Zero Hedge. This actually came out Wednesday this week. I didn't do it because it didn't fit then, but it sure does now. Kavanaugh has declined $600,000 from GoFundMe. Evidently, somebody set up a campaign in his honor to cover his legal fees, while his accuser, you know the name, don't you? Christine Blasey Ford, who lives in a $3 million house in Palo Alto, California, raked in a cool $1 million in donations from her own crowdfunding campaigns, and according to Paul Sperry of Real Clear Investigations, has been fielding a number of book offers. No, nothing wrong here, certainly no quid pro quo, wink wink, nudge nudge. The story said Justice Kavanaugh didn't authorize the use of his name to raise funds in connection with that GoFundMe campaign, and he wasn't able to do so for judicial ethics reasons. Wow, you mean there are still some to whom that matters? And while he appreciates the sentiment, he said, Justice Kavanaugh requests that those involved discontinue the use of his name for any fundraising purposes. Unquote. For her part, said Sperry, Christine Blasey Ford is looking at a potential seven-figure windfall, which she says she intends to cash in, while continuing to ask donors for still more money. More money, more money, more money. And maybe you remember this.
It's a family motto.
Are you ready, Jim?
I'm ready.
Just want to make sure you're ready, brother.
Here it is. Show me the money.
Jerry, use money.
Oh, no, you can do better than that, Jerry. I want you to say what you would mean it, brother. What you gonna do, Jerry?
Give me the money!
Congratulations, you're still my agent.
And said an attorney familiar with the investigation, SIC, conducted by the committee, quote, her lawyer said they were representing her on a pro bono basis, so why does she need all of this money, unquote. And, hey, folks, ain't it obvious? All right, so I think we get the picture, but are you ready for this? Lorraine Parsons declined to speak by telephone to various journalists who couldn't confirm any information about her, including whether that's the real name of the person actually emailing those journalists, or even whether a Lorraine Parsons exists at all. Berkman and Wool maintain they've never interacted with Lorraine Parsons and claim she's a phantom the media is using to discredit the real accuser. Quote, the media is reporting on Parsons, he said, to distract from and discredit the real allegation. Who is this woman? Who created her? Probably Mueller. Probably the mainstream media. I don't know. That'll probably come out some as well, he continued. But the accuser gave us her story. She went point by point. She gave us time. She gave us dates. We carefully vetted that story. We wrote it into an affidavit, which she has signed. Whoa! Imagine that, folks. She's actually willing to sign something under oath. Who could have thought it? And is that a bit different? She also has, and I hope you're sitting down right, quote, a corroborating witness, unquote. The woman Wohl and Berkman claim is accusing Mueller of sexual assault is wealthy and has nothing to financially gain from fabricating allegations anyway, argued Wohl. The accuser, he said, is not a person off the streets. This is a person of unimpeachable character with an illustrious background as a fashion designer, well-educated, well-networked, well-liked, not somebody dragged up from some politically charged area. In fact, she's not politically charged at all, never registered to vote, never voted, in fact, so forth and so on. Well, again, folks, what's interesting here is that there's a lot more to this story, and most certainly to the attempts to short-circuit it. Which brings us to the press conference that was supposed to have been happening while I was doing this recording. The woman accusing Mueller of rape, says this story, was slated to detail her encounter with the special counsel at a press conference Berkman and Wool were hosting in Arlington, Virginia on Thursday at noon. However, upon arriving in Washington, D.C., Wohl said the woman panicked and boarded a flight instead to another location because, at this time, she is fearful for her life and figures if she wants to remain alive, she'd better remain anonymous. And I guess, if you stop and think about it, that does seem to be the really big difference between this story and all those women who gained fame and notoriety and, in at least one case, a whole lot of bucks and were more than willing to risk the consequences. Maybe because they knew the people whose lives they were trying to destroy weren't willing to kill them to keep things covered up. And again, that too speaks volumes and really kind of nails the differences that we're talking about here. And when it comes to the infamous Robert Mueller, there's one more really, let's just say, interesting event that's happened over the last few days. For the next piece, I refer to Dave Hodges of the Common Sense Show, although he's not alone in drawing some of these connections, who writes that it was Robert Mueller who stood to gain the most from the murder of a fellow named Whitey Bulger, who was captured in 2011 after 16 years on the run and was found dead, brutally tortured and murdered is probably a better way to put it, on his very first day after being transferred to a high-security facility in West Virginia. Now, this story is just one of the many Robert Mueller stories that actually goes a lot deeper and is a lot more complicated than you've probably ever been told about by the waste stream. Hodges asked some questions in the process of this piece, which is pretty long. I'm not going to go through all of it, but we'll set the stage. What role, he asked, did Robert Mueller play in the illegal, conflict of interest laden, and very cozy relationship between the FBI and the Boston Mafia figures, as opposed to the Dixie Mafia figures that he's now involved with, that resulted in multiple murders, blackmail, RICO violations, witness tampering, and many more crimes involving FBI complicity under the direction of the fellow who was head of that infamous agency not too long ago, and right before the 9/11 incident, Mr. Fix-It, and what's being covered up in this latest and almost certain murder for hire? Well, basically, folks, it involves FBI informants, evidently quite a few of them, and we're getting used to that now, aren't we? Double crosses, cover-ups, and witnesses who have a consistent tendency to die before they're ever able to testify against their real handlers. Here's a really great quote from attorney Alan Dershowitz, who confirms in an interview he gave to Newsmax ripping the integrity sick of Robert Mueller as special prosecutor, quote, "He's the guy who kept four innocent people in prison for many years in order to protect the cover of Whitey Bulger as an FBI informer. Those of us in Boston didn't have such a high regard for Mueller because we remembered this story. The government had to pay out tens of millions of dollars because Whitey Bulger, a notorious mass murderer, became a government informer against the mafia." And he said that's regarded in Boston as one of the greatest scandals of modern judicial history, and Mueller was right at the center of it. So he's not without criticism by people who know him in Boston. Hodges goes on to recap the Bill and Hill connection between Mueller and Uranium One and all the skullduggery and scumbaggery there. Most regular listeners have at least heard about that, certainly more so than CNN viewers would have. Writes Hodges, "Robert Mueller is a monster of the highest order, and the fact that this heinous figure could get himself appointed to conduct a witch hunt against the president is nothing short of shocking. But, I'll say it again, folks, if you've been paying attention, none of this will at least surprise us anymore." And hey, do you remember how a fellow named Khashoggi just bit the big one in Turkey? And some have suggested it might have had something to do with what he knew about 9/11. Hodges concludes that new evidence is surfacing, in spite of some of those efforts, that Mueller and Comey attempted to cover up 9/11, and the criminal corruption of the Obama regime knew no bounds, and right at the center of it was Robert Mueller. So, who had Whitey Bulger killed while he was in federal custody? It was certainly an inside job, and at least a few people are beginning to suspect they may smell a familiar stench in the whole stinking mess. And can you at least begin to understand why somebody who's been raped by a guy like this might very well know that he's capable of killing her? Unlike, say, a newly minted Supreme Court justice or those who are supporting him. We're talking about a really nasty crew here, folks, and that's the key, again, to understanding this whole thing. Which takes me back to the Alicia Powell article from the Gateway Pundit. "Reporters in the waste-stream media are intent on protecting Mueller," she writes, "and have relentlessly harassed and smeared Wall since learning that he'll bring forth that woman accusing Mueller of sexual assault." The journalist explained, quote, "The reaction of the press has been one of the most disturbing things I've ever seen. I had Oliver Darcy from CNN calling up my 11-year-old sister while she's sitting in her sixth-grade classroom over and over again. I've had Rachel Maddow implicating my mother in this simply because my cell phone happens to be on a family plan, which is perfectly normal, but it's been reported to law enforcement. This," he says, "is, as we all know, an effort to protect Robert Mueller, who many people know to be a character who's not on the up and up. These allegations will come forward. The accusers will tell their stories in a credible way with corroboration. And here, folks," your host interjects, "unless perhaps they end up being Whitey Bulgered." And remember, that was on his first day after being transferred to a new federal prison. So let me say it again. These allegations haven't been proven. It's just that there's a whole different way that they're being treated, which ought to raise more than a few eyebrows. So here's how I'd summarize this, folks. Robert Mueller, the fixer, the man who, oh so coincidentally, has been associated with or implicated in so many high-profile false flags and cover-ups in American history, from 9/11 on. And now this chief crocodile has spent 2 years supposedly investigating a man who wasn't supposed to have been elected if the fix had worked, and hasn't managed to turn up a shred of evidence that he already knew wasn't going to be there anyway. Surprise, surprise, surprise. And Mueller knows darn well why. Because when it comes to Russia, he was evidently one of the point men for Uranium One and Team Hitlery. And there's far more evidence to suggest that he was involved in treason than there ever was to suggest Brett Kavanaugh messed with some high school girl 35-plus years ago. So, is it just possible that, like so many of his mentors, Mueller is guilty of rape as well as treason and all kinds of other criminal acts? Well, if nothing else, he's certainly in good company among those he's been covering up for. And if you know how mafia operations work, folks, this is precisely the pattern you'd expect. Which takes us to the bottom of the hour break, so when we come back, we'll talk about some of the other stories this week that make the same point, as well as the implications of how all of this fits together.
Just like yesterday, and I'll get on my
Welcome back now to the second segment for this evening. I'm your host, Mark Hall. And if there's a theme for this show, it must have to do with deception and things that we're being told that aren't true. More importantly, to cover up things that we aren't being told that are. And no doubt one of those, a big one of those, is what I've been calling the mercenary migrant invasion caravan. Although last I checked, given the new ones that keep coming out of the woodwork or out of Honduras or El Salvador or wherever, we're up to at least four by now. And arguably that doesn't count the troops that have been pre-positioned, waiting to join up with these caravans when they get far enough north. And what anybody who's ever been involved with something like Army logistics can tell you is that there's a huge planning and pre-positioning effort, as well as a support effort, required to move, house, feed, clothe, and yeah, they got lots of nice new clothes in some cases, along with backpacks and tennis shoes, and provide sanitary facilities for these huge numbers of people. And guess what? Stories about the funding sources just don't quite seem to merit inclusion on most of the Waystream network coverage. And since George Soros seems to be a big player through his various open society, sick foundations, if you even point that out, they'll call you an anti-Semite, although arguably, if you look at Soros' history, he deserves that term himself far more than anybody who points out the evil he's been up to since his early days of being an admitted supporter of the Third Reich, or at least the things they were accomplishing. And you can check that out for yourself if you can still find the infamous 60 Minutes interview online. Better hurry, though. And just to kind of make the point, I'm looking at a Jeffrey Grider headline entitled, New York Times Begins Propaganda Campaign in an Attempt to Sanitize George Soros Ahead of the Midterm Elections. After a huge infusion of cash, it says, from Soros, and he bought a bunch of stock in the New York Times, too, the birdcage liner of record began a series of articles and videos attempting to show George Soros not for the villain that he is, it says, but as a, quote, misunderstood philanthropist, unfairly maligned by right-wing extremists. By which, your host concludes, they must mean any of us who don't believe, as they do, that St. Hitler should have been ensconced in the Oval Office, regardless of trivialities like an election and the Electoral College. Which means we need to go next back to the multiple mercenary migrant invasion caravans. Two stories first to begin that summary, both from the Daily Mail out of the UK. Trump has sent 5,200 troops, backed by 150 miles of razor wire, as well as Black Hawk helicopters, drones, and C-130s, to the Mexican border in order to deter that invasion from ever arriving. Meanwhile, agents rehearse for riots in El Paso. 800 troops, as we reported last week, were already en route by Monday, a force the Department of Defense is saying is dramatically increased by adding helicopter companies and engineers bringing heavy equipment. And in total, the DOD is sending 5,200 troops to harden the border, said the Pentagon at a briefing Monday. By the end of the week, we are hearing that number up to more like 14,000. And as more than a few people who actually know how serious this escalation and mercenary invasion is intended to get have pointed out, this is the largest invasion force ever gathered south of the border in the history of the United States. Oh, and in case you're wondering, I certainly was, Santa Ana had less than 2,000 troops when they massacred the Alamo, including men like William Travis, Jim Bowie, and Davy Crockett. And while the Daily Mail continues to say that the president calls it an invasion, but it really isn't, they do admit in another headline that a second migrant caravan has now stormed into Mexico with a violent group from Central America among them carrying bombs. Molotov cocktails is probably a better description, and guns, defying a huge police presence to cross the border from Guatemala. The Daily Mail also does note this. The second group back at the Guatemalan frontier has been more unruly than the first one that crossed. Why does that not surprise us? Guatemala's Interior Ministry said that their police officers were injured when the migrant group broke through border barriers on Guatemala's side of the bridge. Many later crossed via the river. One man died in that attempt. Some were seen carrying guns and firebombs. And on Monday, Mexican Interior Secretary Alfonso Navarrete Prida lamented what he called a second violent attempt to cross the border, accusing people, now listen carefully to this, folks, of placing the elderly, pregnant women, and children at the front, putting them at risk of being crushed. Fortunately, he said, that did not happen. Unquote. But that certainly doesn't mean we can't expect to see similar tactics again. And by Friday, of course, as we've already mentioned, there were at least some reports of up to two additional caravans, bringing the total to, well, four plus anyway, headed in this direction. And the president also weighed in on the issue of deadly force. Taking note of what's already been happening further south, the president indicated he wanted to allow the border troops to defend themselves, with deadly force if necessary, because people armed with rocks can also kill you, just like any number of other makeshift or improvised weapons. And more importantly, folks, I think he's recognizing and tipping the American people off to the fact that when you see this kind of organization and intent to plan and execute a major invasion, you'd better be ready for the rest of what's coming. And that includes not only the current media smokescreen, but also the media barrage that's absolutely certain to follow any escalation, no doubt already planned. The related assault on the First Amendment by so-called private companies that are only really private when it suits them continued to escalate this week. And since that's almost old news by now, I want to spend a couple of minutes on a Joseph Farah piece. He's the editor of WorldNetDaily.com, dealing with a response. And it's entitled, My Three-Point Plan for Toppling the Google-Facebook Cabal. Here's what you need to know, he says. Yeah, there's not much ambiguity begins in the way I view Google, Facebook, and the rest of the digital speech code cartel. There are no shades of gray. There's a little nuance. And that's generally, he says, how he views totalitarians and all would-be totalitarians anyway. And still, no matter how frequently we try to explain these monopolistic mega-corporations that have destroyed all restrictions on surveillance for profit, they're now looking to do the same thing to free speech. And no matter how much the search social media monoliths have attacked freedom of the press and freedom of religion, and no matter how they threaten to render free elections of the future moot events, still, only a small percentage of the American people have any notion of the existential peril they pose to liberty. So he says, I guess I better keep this simple. Before you come to regret ignoring my cries in the wilderness about what'll happen to this nation over the next 2 years if the Google, Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Amazon, Apple cabal is not reduced to a size small enough to drown in your own bathtub, let me share a few points and a few plans. And in fact, he says, anyone who hasn't noticed the willingness, well, nay, even the eagerness of these companies to squash any and all political dissent probably either approves of it or simply can't comprehend their darkness, their evil, and their hideous malevolence. So here come the facts. Fact, Amazon has acquiesced to the largest government on earth to ban the sale of Bibles inside China. Did you know about that? Does it bother you that one of the highest-ranking leaders of the Democrat Party is lobbying Amazon to ban the sale of other books in the U.S.? So-called hate speech, as defined by the extremist Trump haters at the Southern Poverty Law Center. Another fact, Google's also back doing the bidding of Big Brother China, selling to the brutes in Beijing the technology they need to make their unique and ruthless blend of communo-fascism more efficient. At the same time, this American company, he puts that in quotes, has made it clear they're not going to cooperate any longer with the actual defense of these formerly free United States and the U.S. military. Another fact, Google and Facebook, or to Facebook, as your host likes to put it, know more about you than you probably may know yourself. And worse, they're experts at monetizing your data while manipulating your thinking and behavior without you having, as a general rule, the slightest inkling. So what would a cartel of that kind of mindset, a godless, socialist, utopian worldview, as well as that kind of extraordinary power, inevitably want to do? Answer, to remake the world in its own image. And that's their goal. Not 10 years from now, not even five, but two, by 2020. So he has some suggestions. You can probably guess what most of them amount to. He does mention a new movie, which I haven't heard of, called The Creepy Line, and suggest people see it. And understand that since Hollywood and Google and all the other fascist media are going to fight it, it's going to take some effort on our parts. And the second one, of course, your host likes, because I talk about it every week, and it basically amounts to, come out of her, my people, although Joe might put it a bit differently. Bottom line, if you're paying attention, it's hard not to see what's being done to free speech and what we need to do about it while we still can. Here's a piece from AFP via France 24 about the growth of what they call Chinese-style digital authoritarianism. Governments worldwide, it says, are stepping up their use of online tools. Can you say Google, Apple, Twitter, to Facebook, YouTube, and the other socialist media platforms? In many cases, inspired by China's model. Or is it China just having adopted Google and Apple's model? Anyway, to suppress dissent and tighten their grip on power, said a human rights watchdog study Thursday. The annual Freedom House study of 65 countries found that global internet freedom had declined for the eighth consecutive year as of 2018 amid a rise in what that group called digital authoritarianism. The Freedom on the Net 2018 report found that online propaganda and disinformation have increasingly poisoned the digital space, while the unbridled collection of personal data is infringing, oh, give me a break, folks, on privacy, kind of like how gun confiscation infringes the right to keep and bear arms. Quote, democracies are struggling in the digital age, while China is exporting its model of censorship and surveillance to control information, both inside and outside its borders, said Michael Abramowitz, president of Freedom House. This pattern poses a threat to the open internet and endangers prospects for greater democracy worldwide. They also noted that Chinese officials have held sessions on controlling information with 36 of the 65 countries assessed. Doesn't say here, though, how many have allowed to Facebook and Google to co-opt their nation's web. The report also found that 17 governments approved or proposed laws, or at least their public-private partners did, restricting online media in the name of fighting fake news. And the ministries of truth know what that means, while 18 countries increased surveillance or weakened encryption protection to more closely monitor their citizenry. One of the greatest threats, said Freedom House, is efforts by China to remake the digital world in its, or in, you know, the public-private partners, techno-dystopian image. And to support that assertion, they cited sweeping Chinese cybersecurity requirements that local and foreign companies immediately stop transmission of banned content and compels them to ensure that data on Chinese users is hosted within the country. That's been followed by hundreds of new directives on what people can and cannot do online, and let's not forget their socialist media scores, too, just in case they get out of line at all, and tighter controls on the use of VPNs, that stands for virtual private networks, to evade detection. Meanwhile, though, a Chinese foreign ministry official spokesman, Liu Kang, at a regular press briefing, said the accusations by Freedom House are, quote, without basis, unprofessional, irresponsible, and have ulterior motives, unquote, for which reason, of course, they're not going to be allowed to be read by the people in China or anywhere else eventually. And that, folks, is why your host really does think that the public-private fascist partnership is so insidiously evil, and why, whether we're talking about Gulag and Two Facebook or George Soros, people really do need to understand the unholy alliance between private Big Brother and public Big Brother. There is at least some good news around the world, because it seems like more and more people, not just in the U.S., but in other places around the world as well, are waking up to what's being done to them. And they may have finally had enough. Interestingly, the headline from the Daily Mail out of the socialist UK is both informative and cautionary. Trump of the tropics, it says Jair Bolsonaro, has won the Brazilian presidential election. This is the guy who was stabbed during the campaign, and he's an ex-soldier who's been blasted, they note right up front, for his comments on rape, race, migration, and homophobia. In a huge victory. It seems like the Brazilian people get it more than the editors of the Daily Mail do. The subheadlines here flesh out the rest of it. Transparent, progressive bias and all. Controversial ex-soldier, it says, Jair Bolsonaro, age 63, has easily won the Brazilian election with almost 56% of the vote. Coming into the second round, the far-right candidate had an 8-to-10-point lead over his leftist opponent. Notice they don't say far-left or communist or anything of that sort. The fiery Bolsonaro, though, it says, in the next one has tapped into deep anti-establishment anger in Brazil following corruption scandals, in spite of the fact, they note, too, that he's been slammed for his, their terminology, racist, homophobic, and sexist views, which they beat over and over again like a mantra throughout this piece. Typical quote from the Daily Mail. He tapped into deep anti-establishment anger throughout the election campaign, but repulsed many, especially, I guess, those in the UK, with his denigrating remarks about women, gay, and black people. Unquote. He defeated Fernando Haddad, and you have to read down into the article before they even tell you he's the former mayor of Sao Paulo, and basically, about as far left as they claim Bolsonaro is far right. And in this case, folks, your host noted that it was so over the top the way they were treating this new guy, I guess the Trump of the tropics pretty well nails the reason why, that I went through and counted in the article how many times they called him far right. Answer, a dozen. How many times was anybody else referred to as far left or anything other than, well, you know, the kind of thing you ought to want instead? Zero. And only once did they even call his opponent a socialist. Deep down into the piece, they really do finally get around to quoting some actual things that he said. He ran, for example, on promises to clean up Brazil and bring back, traditional values and said he would respect the Constitution and personal liberty. Wow, no wonder they hate him. And then he said this after his victory, quote, "I first want to thank God. This is not the promise of a party, nor the word of a man. It is an oath before God. We will change Brazil's destiny together." And then he added other things that just don't sit well with the leftist progressive media worldwide. He pledged to govern following the Bible and the Constitution and added, quote, "We cannot continue flirting with socialism, communism, populism, and the extremism of the left," unquote. I guess the bottom line is congratulations to Brazil and to the new Mr. President, and I suspect he knows this by now. You'd better watch your back. Next, I want to spend a few minutes on a really interesting piece that really has a lot more to do with the fall of the money aspects of what's going on than you might at first think, which makes it a great way to start connecting a lot of dots tonight. This comes from Eric Peters Autos, and if you've ever read Eric's work, you know he's not only an auto expert and reviewer, but he's also a libertarian at heart, with a pretty good understanding of economics, too, which is the real point behind this piece. He begins by asking a question. Why is General Motors, which only sells one electric car, now pushing for a national electric car mandate? Honda and several others are too. It's not unlike, he suggests, a steakhouse lobbying for a national vegan menu requirement. You gotta wonder why. Well, he says, allow me to elucidate. The FedGov has already de facto outlawed non-electric cars, using a kind of slow-acting poison that's already causing symptoms to appear and will shortly fell even the healthiest-seeming non-electric vehicles, especially big trucks and SUVs. That poison is the Federal Fuel Economy FATWA, known as CAFE. Yeah, you know what it stands for, Corporate Average Fuel Economy, which has been around since the 1970s, but it's now on schedule to almost double within about 5 years. Meaning that by model year 2025, vehicles, and not just cars, will have to average 50-plus miles per gallon, which didn't used to be so hard before all the other mandates that made it almost impossible to do that. This includes, he says, trucks and SUVs based on trucks, which GM does sell a heck of a lot of. So how do you get a truck or SUV based on a truck to average 50-plus MPG? Answer, you don't. Therein lies the rub. So what you have to do instead is to improve your CAFE fleet average by folding cars that get infinite miles per gallon, of gasoline anyway, even though they don't get that many actual miles down the road, into the equation. And guess what? That means electric cars that don't burn any gas. One EV plus one SUV that averages, say, 20 miles per gallon equals a lot better than 20 MPG. So the more EVs you sell, or, actually, better put, give away at a net loss, if you're Tesla, of course, you can even get Big Brother to subsidize them, well, the more SUVs and trucks you can still actually sell, although the prices will have to go up. If you ask enough for them and people want them badly enough, you might actually still be able to make a profit, which is what GM and the others who are selling them need to sell, because that's, of course, where the real money is. And the even bigger problem is that electric cars aren't selling. Well, says Peters, this shouldn't be any more perplexing than being baffled by diners at a steakhouse failing to order the soy turkey burger with quinoa from the vegan menu, especially when that soy burger costs twice what a ribeye does. And those of us who've studied it, folks, would say you're better off eating the ribeye than the soy besides, since it's virtually guaranteed to be Frankenfood. Maybe there's a message there. So let's take a look at history. The government, via CAFE standards, nudged Americans out of big sedans with big V8s and into big SUVs and trucks instead that still had V8s, because lots of Americans didn't want to be nudged into smaller cars. And at least for a while, big SUVs and trucks weren't affected as abusively by the CAFE regs, so the car companies began to sell lots of them to meet the diverted market demand for large, powerful vehicles. Trouble is, CAFE now applies to all vehicles, including trucks and SUVs, so Uncle has closed the truck SUV loophole, he puts it in quotes, and you know that was done at bayonet point, because Uncle never actually suggests, he just mandates, and of course if you're a good little car company and you want to stay in business, you better go along or else. Anyway, trucks and SUVs, other larger, stronger vehicles, continue to sell. Or rather, they're the types of vehicles, says Peters, that can still be sold at a profit without mandates or subsidies, unlike electric cars. But given the Lumen 50 MPG plus mandate, it's extremely necessary to, sell the EVs, whether consumers want them or not, in order to be able to actually sell anything else without incurring colossal gas guzzler fines, which is the penalty Big Brother imposes for not meeting the CAFE mandatory minimums. Now let's pause here for a second, folks, and note that there are some other not very well hidden reasons for the mandate, too. There's the idea of treating carbon dioxide as an exhaust emission, thanks to the bogus carbon footprint and non-existent man-made global warming BS. That's bad science, don't you know? In Europe, you're already seeing combustion engine no-go zones decreed, and that'll be coming soon to a theater near you as well. And Peters doesn't mention it, but I will. If you really do intend to control the population by moving people out of their own independently piloted actual cars and into self-driving EVs controlled with and via the Internet of Things, the electric vehicle mandate and subsidy is a great way to get there now, isn't it? So back to Eric Peters, who says only zero-emission EVs qualify for all of the wonderful new stuff coming down the pike, even though they really aren't zero emissions any more than your house is, assuming it has an electrical hookup. The electrically powered appliances in your house, he says, may not emit anything inside or even outside your house, but how about down the road? Remember, the electricity-generating plant that makes it certainly does emit something, including carbon dioxide, and a utility plant has a carbon footprint probably larger than about 100,000 gas-engined SUVs. But hey, these are bureaucrats we're talking, folks, and politicians, and actual logic is the furthest thing from their mind. Oh, and let's not forget, of course, that there's nothing actually harmful about these emissions anyway. Those fretting about carbon dioxide, as he puts it, are the hobgoblin of illiterates and neurotics and what Lenin once rightfully called the useful idiots. They've been known to get upset about dihydrogen monoxide, too. But never mind the false flag threats that are used to justify all of this. The fatwas are already a fait accompli. And even if Uncle doesn't impose the 50-plus MPG fatwa nationally, California already has, and that leaves GM et al. In the position of either having to abandon the California market, as well as the market for about a half a dozen other states that have enacted their own similar mandates, or they have to swallow a huge loss building electric-compliant cars and offloading them at, fire sale prices. So the solution, the only real solution, if you understand how Big Brother works, is a national EV mandate, which they hope will enable them to spread out their costs by offloading them onto the backs of buyers everywhere. And if every step mandates the production of a certain number of EVs each year, how long will it be before Big Brother mandates that people buy them? Hey, they can do it with insurance, right? Why not? So understand that none of this, and he means none of it, and your host concurs, is driven by actual natural market forces. Because there is no natural market for electric vehicles. Well, folks, maybe outside of a golf course. And Big Brother, therefore, has to create one for the purpose of increasing its control over the mobility of the masses. Most people won't even be able to afford an EV, even if it's subsidized, but especially if it eventually isn't. And even those who can will definitely have their mobility limited by the range and recharge times, as well as access, for a long time anyway, to recharging facilities. And hey, how better to control things in the long term anyway? Finally, people that don't have garages or access to places to plug them in are going to find that their mobility options have been stymied altogether. And all of this means the end of the car business as we once knew it. Now, GM may, he says, be able to think they can do business in an all-EV future, but what's coming, and what GM and the other useful idiots are helping along, is an East German-style regime in which the elites have their latter-day Zis limos and huge SUVs, possibly electric, but the proletariat is reduced to ride-sharing. When they're allowed to. And that's, of course, if Big Brother's vehicles actually want to allow them to go where they'd want to go anyway. Since your host frequently talks about the evil of the fascism known as the public-private partnership, consider all of this in the light of, well, freedom of speech. If you can force a car company to literally demand what you didn't think they'd ever want to demand, because if they don't, their partner puts them out of business, it's a little easier to see how free speech, too, enters the same death spiral. So use it as best you can while you can.